Hi, welcome. Hello, Maraca.
Hi.
Erica?
Yeah.
Erica? Hello, everybody on the internet, and hello, everybody in class. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm just going to put us on Facebook Live, then we will be ready to go. Oh, that was the one. There you go.
Welcome, everyone. Beautiful out, huh? Look gorgeous out. How are you, Justin?
Sorry, this is a new computer. I gotta fix one thing.
Is anyone in Central Park this past weekend?
Oh,
at MGE? No. I heard we had 50 people. The 26 sign up.
Oh, Jesus.
I love it.
Oh,
okay. Yeah.
Okay. I just got to get, it's a new computer, so I'm not logged in on Facebook, but we are.
Can we do the Facebook login from someone else?
Well, I was logged in. I didn't realize it wasn't going to. Okay, give me 1 second. I just have to change the default browser. Sorry, I thought it was all set. Yes, everyone is on Zoom. Give me 1 second, guys, and we will get started. New computer troubles. Okay, I got it. There we go. Man. Okay, we are live on the TV. And we will be live on Facebook in 2 seconds, and we'll be ready to get started.
Never too late to do something. He's asking, is it too late to say she'll go to something? Is there like a cutoff?
I don't know.
All right. We are live. Oh, we're almost live on Facebook.
Yeah. You just didn't do it.
All right. We're live on Facebook. We are recording this and we are ready to go. I'm going to leave this open so you can see chat and if people get admitted. We are all set there and there. And Reverend Wild, everyone.
Okay, thank you. Wait, let's see. Okay. Hey, guys, can you hear me? Oh, you're all waving. That's so sweet. Can you guys see everyone here? Excellent. Can someone speak from Zoom? Maya, before you go in, hang on 1 second.
Hi.
Hi there.
I can hear you here. Wait, can you just do it again? Speak again.
For hi, Rabbi.
Hello, Rabbi. Hello, New York.
Can you hear them, guys?
No, I'm not.
Okay. All right, I'm going to start in the meantime because you can hear me and you can hear me.
You can teach.
Hello, Juliet. Nice to see you. Hello, Marv, Stephanie. Just raise your hand. Wave your hand when I say your name. We're going to do a Peloton moment. Scott, say something. Just speak.
Hey, Rabbi. How you doing?
No? Okay, good. We're doing well. It is absolutely beautiful on the roof. You see the schach above me? That's the roof for a sukkah. We're keeping it sukkah for quite a while. Welcome. How are you, Hannah?
Can someone else say something? Whose turn is it now? Stephanie, can you say something?
Hello.
There we go. We are all set. Thank you.
Can you guys hear? Okay, good.
All right,
and I'm welcoming Sharon. Hello, Sharon. Hello, Chase. What's going on, Chase? I don't see a pretty face there, but...
Hello, this is Sharon. Hello.
Nice to have you.
The one time you yell that you don't see me.
That's okay. I'm not taking it personally, but if you want to be seen, you know, put your face on. Hello, Jules Glick is here and Richard. Melissa Jamie Cookie. Is that your name?
I typically go by Cookie.
Okay, fine. Hello, Nati. Welcome back, Nati. And Nikita, pleasure to have you. Hello, Erica. How are you? Can you hear me, Erica? Excellent. Okay. And Scott, Stephanie. Hello, Stephanie. Welcome back. And the Hershensons. What an honor and a pleasure. Okay, and here. Just let's go around quickly. Just say your names. Andre's with us. You can't see him. You can hear him probably through this, but they can see. He can see you, so behave. Yes. Sarah, what's your last name? Welcome, Sarah. Okay, please. Hello, Daniela. Welcome back.
Rachel Hershow.
Hello, Rachel. Hannah Pasternak is with us. Justin. Justin is so. Maya's pointing a gun at Justin's temple. It's a thermometer, actually, although it looks like she's shooting him. Keep going. Jennifer. Victoria. Okay. The idea, I guess, is to do this before they come in because it's embarrassing once you're here. All right. Oh, a light. Okay, we're going to get started with one of my favorite topics. Before we get started, I just want to make one important announcement. Every Shabbat, we've been meeting up here at Friday night services. It's really been beautiful. We can have up till 30 people up here. It's at 6 o'clock. I'm going to be leading services this Friday night at 6 o'clock. If you're interested, Maya, we're having a Shabbat dinner, right?
Yes, we are having a Shabbat dinner at Hampton Inn Burger. I will be sending a link to everyone who
have
already gotten a link this morning to sign up. Sign up tonight so you can get
the
early bird discount.
Awesome. And that is going to be Friday night. Saturday, we're meeting at Turtle Pond. Has anyone been to Turtle Pond in Central Park? It's a very cute little sweet place. We've daven pray facing the water. It's really nice. And we're meeting there at 9:30 on Saturday. Sunday, and I'm really proud of our amazing staff here at MGE. Every single year we do a blood drive and mitzvah fair. And I thought this year, how are we going to do a blood drive and a mitzvah fair? We're doing a blood drive and a mitzvah fair. We already have 70 people registered for donating. And every pint of blood saves three lives. And goes to New York's blood bank. It's going to be taking place all throughout the day. You make an appointment. It's going to be on the first floor. You don't even have to go into the elevator. The blood bank's going to be down on the first floor, and we're going to have a sofer. Check your mezuzot or tefillin if you would like. That's the mitzvah part on the 10th floor. And also a gentleman that checks shatnez. We don't mix wool and linen. And therefore, we come with our wool clothing that might have linen in it. We get it checked. We've been doing that every year for many years, and we're pulling it off this year again. Anybody who's interested, 10 in the morning here on the roof, I'm going to be giving a class on kindness, acts of kindness. My family sponsors this event every year in memory of my father-in-law. Jill's dad was a big blood donor his whole life. So we decided when he passed away 13 years ago, to sponsor a blood drive every year in his memory, and some other mitzvah stuff floating around. So that's this Sunday if anybody wants to come. The class will be here at 10 o'clock. We're sending out some stuff. You can just show up, actually. But to donate blood, you need to make an appointment. And it's, where is it? It's on the website, all this?
Yeah, for the, on Facebook, and an email that was sent out at 7 p.m. today. And
okay, excellent. Okay. All right. Let's get to our discussion. You know, this course is called mindfulness, and our conversation tonight is about relationships. And I truly believe that the way we think about relationships, the way we think about connecting with each other, and I'm going to speak about romantic relationships tonight, very much has to do and will affect the way we go ahead and forward with cultivating relationships, finding our soulmate, and making that relationship last. There's a great monologue of Jerry Seinfeld. Any Seinfeld rerun fans here? Anybody? Yes, thank you. Well, thank you, Stephanie and the Hershensons and Scott. Nobody live, Seinfeld? So he's got a great monologue where he says the following, Jerry Seinfeld. You know, it was in the beginning of one of the shows that he always does the monologue first, then the other show, and So he said the following. He says, why is commitment such a big problem for a man? I think that for some reason, when a man is driving down that freeway of love, the woman he's with is like an exit. But he doesn't want to get off there. He just wants to keep driving. And the woman is like, look, gas, food, lodging, that's our exit. That's everything we need to be happy. Get off here, get off now. The man is focusing on the sign beneath that says, next exit, 27 miles. And he thinks, I can make it. Sometimes he can, sometimes he can't. Sometimes the car ends up on the side of the road, the hood is up, smoke is pouring out of the engine. He's sitting on the curb all alone, mumbling to himself, I guess I didn't realize how many miles I was racking up. And I wanted to start with this cute little line from Jerry Seinfeld, because the image of driving and driving and never wanting to get off is a very telling image in our society. Years ago, there was a great article in the Times that discussed the current dating scene for people in their 20s and 30s. And the article talked about how, on one hand, people were really interested in developing relationships, not just one-night stands. On the other hand, how people, young people today, really value their independence and not having to settle down or make a commitment. It's like a dirty word for some people, commitment. Who wants to make a commitment? It's not just men. Men get a bad rap. You can't make a commitment. Making commitments is hard for, I think, everybody. And my question is, what is Judaism's take on this, specifically when it comes to relationship? Can you have your cake and eat it? Which is my question really is, can you get out of a relationship what a relationship can give us that I think everyone is looking for without having to make that full commitment? Now, I could end the class and just say no, but let me explain why and how we can go about doing this. So take a look at your handout. I want to share a little piece of Torah. And with your permission, it says page 38 and 39. I'm not sure why. There's got to be some Kabbalah about what happened to the first 37 pages. Just kidding. Don't worry about that. Just go to page 38. I'd like to devote and dedicate my talk tonight to the memory of the late and great Rabbi Jonathan Sacks. Many of you know and have heard of Rabbi Sacks because either you've read something from him or you've heard me quote him one out of a gabillion times. It was a very unfortunate news. I don't know if you remember, but about a month ago, I posted something saying that he was beginning to battle cancer, and I just really thought he was going to make it, and unfortunately, he passed on Shabbat. And he was an extraordinary, extraordinary scholar and person. He spoke here at MGE, and he was a big fan of the work we do. He loved how many people met and married at MGE. That's what, like, he was super impressed with. And when he spoke here, he talked about that for a while. So I thought, with your permission, we could devote our Torah tonight to his memory, to his Elohim Neshama, to the elevation of his very, very holy soul. So take a look at source number one. And can we get a volunteer? Let's get somebody live first to read source, the first chapter one, and we'll get somebody online to read chapter two.
Is there a link?
Oh.
Yes.
Okay. Okay. Oh, you guys don't have it. Okay. Okay, I'm going to read it slowly. So, guys, I'm going to read it because they can't hear you. So I just don't want to waste time, so if you don't mind. So in chapter one, it says in the book of Genesis, and just pay attention as best as you can. You don't need to see it inside. God created man in his image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. Sorry about the noise in the background. God blessed them and said to them, be fertile and multiply, fill the land and subdue it. Have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the sky, and over every beast that walks upon the earth. I'm going to read it again. God created man in his image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and multiply, fill the land, subdue it. Have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the sky, over every beast that walks upon the earth. You got that, guys? Okay, now, I want to read to you, and those of you live, take a look at chapter 2. Try to keep in mind what I just read as much as you can. And as I read just one or two lines from chapter 2, tell me what strikes you as being different. You see, the Torah describes Adam and Eve's creation, both in chapter 1 and in chapter 2, but very differently. Chapter 2, the Eternal God formed man out of the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils a breath of life. And man thus became a living soul. The Eternal God planted a garden in Eden to the east. He placed man that he had formed to cultivate it and to watch it. I'll read the second one again for those of you who don't have the source. The Eternal God formed man out of the dust of the ground, breathed into his nostrils a breath of life. Man thus became a living soul. The Eternal God planted a garden in the Eden to the east. He placed the man that he had formed to cultivate it and to watch it. What is the first most dramatic distinction that leaps out between the way Adam and Eve's creation is described in chapter 1 and the way it's described in chapter 2? What do you think? Yes. Okay, but yeah, now, I'm so sorry. What's your first name again? Sarah. So Sarah, actually, the first word you said actually picked up on the difference. Well, what's the first word you actually said? In chapter 1, who is it talking about? Even the guys, the ladies and gents on Zoom, who was chapter 1 speaking about? And God created man in his image, and the image of God he created him, male and female, he created them. Did you hear any mention about female in chapter 2 at all? Where is Eve in chapter 2? All it says in chapter 2 is that God formed man out of the dust of the ground, breathed into his nostrils a breath of life. Where's Eve? When does Eve come into the picture in chapter 2, actually? Many of you know this. Remember Adam then takes a nap? He goes to sleep, very deep sleep, and then he wakes up. And his side is missing and it's been replaced by Eve. How is Adam described in chapter 1 versus chapter 2? Chapter 2, there is no Eve in the beginning. It's just Adam. He's alone with all the animals for quite some time until God says it's not good for man to be alone. In chapter 1, what do you see? It says he created him, male and female, he created them. What does that mean? Male and female, he created them.
Rabbi Mark, the image I have is like one side is the male, the other side is the female. They were incorporated in one body.
Exactly. That's exactly what the Talmud says, and the Kabbalah has a whole discussion about this, that original man, according to chapter 1, was a hermaphrodite. It was a composite of both male and female. Some say that the front was male, the back was female. But Adam and Eve were one, literally one. In chapter 2, Adam and Eve are separate individual beings. Eve is not even created until later on. That's one major difference. The second difference you just picked up on, you were starting to say.
I would say that in chapter 1, he talked about the creation.
Yeah.
Chapter 2, he talked about the creation.
Good, their jobs. What was their jobs, Adam in chapter 1? What was his job? His job was to have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the sky, over every beast that walks upon the earth. Chapter 2, what's the job? To cultivate it and to watch it. Doesn't sound as hard in chapter 2, does it? Not so simple. What's that? Chapter 2, good. Adam and Eve in chapter 2 sound a little more soulful. They're not told to manipulate the world, harness the forces of nature. you know, partner with God in subduing the animals and in subjecting the world to human initiative. Chapter 2, it's like, just take a step back. Interesting, is there a relationship now between the fact that Adam and Eve are created simultaneously in chapter 1 and their job, which is to have dominion over the world? And in chapter 2, when Adam is created all alone, until finally God says it's not good for a person to be alone, I'm going to create a helpmate for him, Eve. And their job is to simply watch, to cultivate, not to subdue the forces of nature to human dominion, but to simply be with the natural world. Rabbi Soloveitchik, in one of the most extraordinary books, and you need to read this book if you haven't, The Lonely Man of Faith, was published by Doubleday in the 1950s, and it's a phenomenal, phenomenal description of the Torah's perspective on human existence. Says the following. Rabbi Soloveitchik said that Adam in chapter 1 is created together with Eve because what's his job? What's his job again, guys? Well, they both have to be fruitful and multiply also, but their job in terms of the environment is rule the land. Rule over the earth and the animals, good. And therefore, the word, by the way, in Hebrew is v'kiv shua. L'chavosh means to conquer, to dominate. The Torah says to subdue, to harness the force of nature. Adam 1's mission, Rabbi Soloveitchik says, he separates into Adam 1 versus Adam 2. Adam 1's mission is to create a better world. And to create a better world, you got to master it somehow. And since Adam in chapter 1 is focused exclusively on trying to tackle the environment, he's therefore, suggests Rabbi Soloveitchik, created together with Eve simply because two hands are better than one. And this is really the, you know, why do people become partners when they go into business? Why do you have to split the profits? Just run the business yourself. There's a reason, because you can do a lot more with somebody else. And this is really the nature of Adam and Eve's relationship as described in chapter 1. It's very practical. It's utilitarian. They satisfy each other's practical needs because they need each other, because they have to tackle the environment. Two hands are better than one. But they're not really bound to each other emotionally. Rabbi Soloveitchik goes on to say that we all know relationships like this, where a couple can really work well together. They can produce together, but they don't connect on a deeper emotional or spiritual level. So the relationship becomes productive, but they're not bound to each other existentially, and therefore the relationship can never become holy. Now, sometimes we have the opposite. Sometimes you meet someone, you have that amazing connection, but you're so bad with each other. Like, this is just not a good idea. Sometimes the relationship sounds perfect on a piece of paper, but then when you're in each other's presence, you're just not feeling that connection. We're obviously looking for a little of both together. I'm sorry? How do I admit? Waiting room? Oh, admit all. Hello, Lisa. Welcome. Sorry if you guys were knocking on our door and we didn't open. Okay. Now, without sounding too cynical, I think that it's a very familiar kind of attitude towards dating and relationships. Adam 1. Remember, Adam 1 and Eve are connected to each other because they need each other. There's nothing wrong with it. They're not abusing each other. They need it. They can just do more with the other. But they're not in it for the other. Adam is created with a drive and need to dominate the environment, and he needs Eve. And we too, I often think when we, in our world, when we go out and date, we have needs, and we look to find a potential spouse to fill them. We have a need for companionship, we have a need for love, to feel security, to feel supported in whatever we may do professionally. These are all legitimate needs. We have a physical need, we have a need to sort of leave a legacy after 120. right? We're mortal beings, and we know that. We don't want to just leave the world without something, you know. So these are legitimate needs and desires. And what do? We go out and we date, and we look for a partner who can satisfy these needs. And it sounds simple and it sounds harmless. The only problem is it doesn't really work. I'm sorry?
And the source sheet is in the comments.
If anybody needs the source sheet, now that I finished reading it, just kidding. There is another page. One second. All I'm seeing is the message here. Oh, waiting room? Oh, there it is. Okay, thank you. So what's the problem with this sort of needs approach? I mean, that's what we do. We here I am. I recognize I'm not complete. I need A, B, and C, and I need to find a partner. The problem is, if it's all about fulfilling our needs, it's never going to happen because it's just impossible to find one person who can fulfill so many different needs. Maybe I can find someone to whom I'm attracted to physically, but they don't make me laugh. Or maybe someone intellectually really is on the same page, but, you know, they don't have the same, you know, desire to have a family like I do, or their concept of a family is just so different. And finding one person with all these things is just unrealistic. And as I'm sure many of us can attest here, as we continue to date, the list keeps growing. And the list keeps changing as we change, because we don't stay the same. We're not supposed to stay the same. Now, that doesn't mean you throw out the list. The list is important. But it could mean that we trim it a little to leave ourselves with what is truly important. One rabbi up at Yeshiva University always likes to say to look for three things. Rabbi Feldman, who was one of our rabbis on the east side, always used to say this. Three things. Midot, which are personality traits. Good midot, which encompasses a certain level of kindness. Number two, physical attraction. And number three, shared values. The shared values is where I would throw in all the Jewish stuff. You know, we want to build a nice Jewish home and all the ones. You know, and the problem is when we have too many things, I need somebody who loves to travel. Okay, that's great. But what if you find someone that has the right personality, you're physically attracted and you have shared values, but they don't love to travel and you do? And I don't mean to make it sound overly trivial. It could mean a lot to somebody to travel. The list just, it's not only unrealistic because it just keeps growing, but it can hamper our ability to develop what Adam 2 has and not Adam 1, which is a deep personal relationship. Since the best relationships are never about what the other person can do for me, but ultimately what I can try to do for them. You know, they tell the story of, it's like a Jewish borscht belt joke. I'm just going to throw it in, so please laugh even if you don't think it's funny. So the guy who complains of chest pains, he goes with his wife to see the doctor. Hang on a minute. I'm getting ready not to have a chuckle. Anyway, the doctor gives the husband this extensive examination. And he asked him to step out and asked the wife to step in. And he says, listen, I examine your husband. He has a very serious stress disorder. And you have to do the following things for him, or he'll be dead in 3 months. He says, every morning, you have to make him a nice hot breakfast and give him a nice relaxing massage every morning. And then make sure that you make for him whatever he wants for lunch and for dinner, and another massage in the evening. And by no means can you nag him or bother him or raise your voice in his presence. And of course, the woman nods, you know, leaves the room. Her husband comes in. He's anxiously waiting. No, what did the doctor say? And what does the wife say? You have 3 months to live. All right. So, you know, the idea that we're going to get into a relationship to simply, sounds better when like Jackie Mason said, that we're going to get into a relationship to simply give to another person. Fulfilling our partner's needs is obviously important, but a relationship which is only based on getting our needs fulfilled is not realistic, but there's something deeper. There's a deeper issue with the needs-oriented approach, because intellect, let's say sense of humor, whatever it is that we think is important, they're just surface needs. What is the most pressing need that every human being existentially has, just by virtue of being a human? And that, I think, we have to go to Adam 2, to chapter 2, to understand. To understand the basic human need to be understood and to be accepted. That's a big deal. And couples many times struggled with that for many, many years. And to be able to understand our need to be understood and ultimately accepted, we got to go back past the way, the very practical needs-oriented relationship in Adam 1, right, where they're created together basically just, you know, for practical purposes. And we need to go into Adam 2. Adam 2 is all alone. And what does it say after a while? God says it's not good for man to be alone. I'll make for him a helpmate. Rav Soloveitchik explained that this, since Adam too was created alone, with no companion with whom to communicate, he becomes existentially insecure. There's no other counterpart. By the way, who was Adam with all of that time before Eve came into the picture? Anybody know? Who was Adam with before Eve came into the picture? What's that? Well, I mean, that's all, the plants. Who else besides the plants? We're going to put Lilith aside for a minute. That's a whole other thing. Now, somebody else. Something else. Animals. Animals. It's in this state, before Eve comes into the picture, that God tells Adam to do what with the animals? Anybody remember?
To name them. Name them.
Chase, thank you. Good. We have somebody in person. Danielle in person and Chase online. You got it. What was the point of Adam naming the animals? Cat, dog, cow. What was the deal with that? So a name in Kabbalah, in Jewish mystical tradition, is supposed to typify the essence of the person. They say that when a parent names a child, they're given like a little siyata deshmaya, a little heavenly help to be able to somehow understand very deeply the essence of the child, to capture it somehow in a name. I'm not talking about our English names. Something about the Hebrew name that is supposed to capture who we are. Now, that process of naming the animals, Rav Soloveitchik said, is what caused Adam to feel so lonely. Because loneliness, he says, is the awareness of your uniqueness and exclusiveness. Very different than being alone. You can be in Madison Square Garden at a rock concert with 20,000 people. We'll get back to that place one day, okay? And you could, like, you're not alone. You're literally in a room with 20,000 other people. But if there's no one in that room or in the world that understands you and accepts you, you can still be lonely. And Adam realized, by being with the animals, naming them, getting to know them well enough to be able to classify all the different animals, the different species, that there was no other being in the world that was like him, that could relate to him and that could understand him, and therefore he felt lonely. Rav Soloveitchik called his book The Lonely Man of Faith. He says a person of faith is by definition lonely because there's only one being that can truly understand us, and that's not even our husbands or wives. And that, as you mentioned before, is God himself. And this is the feeling, says Rav Soloveitchik, that each and every human being is plagued with by virtue of being a unique human, distinct from all other people. And that's why, and by the way, this is the depressing part of the class. It's going to get a little happier because this sounds like a little heavy. I'm getting a little existential on you. That's why the only way, at least, of partially defeating the existential loneliness is being someone with someone who understands you, someone who gets you, and as I said before, more importantly, accepts you with the flaws, with our issues and our problems. And how can that happen? I'm going to come back full circle now to dating and relationship building. That can only happen if what? What do you need for someone to actually understand you? And this is the tricky part of dating.
To communicate.
You need to communicate to them a little even more deeply. Yeah, Juliet?
You need to accept them. You need to be more accepting of yourself and of others.
First of all, I think it's good what you said about yourself, because how can you expect somebody else to accept you if you don't? That's why the Torah says, "V'ahavta l'recha kamocha," love your neighbor as yourself. Very hard for other people to love you if you don't have that own sense of self-love.
Are we getting into a Platonian other half concept, both in another half of Hashem and the other half of Eve?
I can't believe I'm taking my sweater off outside, but I'm so hot. Yes, it is connected to what Plato wrote about on top on this. I'm going a little of a different direction, though, Chase. All right? Stick with me here.
So it's not all Greek to me.
Dude. So what else do you need to do? A lot of people are challenged on dating to do this. What's that? Attach? Well, okay. I'm going to broaden it, but it actually is connected to touch. It can only really happen if you reveal yourself so the other person can truly get to know you. How can you expect someone else to understand you if they don't really know you? And how's anyone going to know you if you don't open yourself up? But wait, you want me to open myself up to someone that I don't have a commitment to, who could be out the door in 5 minutes? That's like emotional suicide. I would never suggest to anyone when dating to do that. That would actually be, I think, dangerous. And by the way, the idea of revealing yourself so the other person can know you, which explains the symbolism of Adam and Eve being completely naked and exposed in the Garden of Eden. They were completely knowledgeable of each other. That, by the way, is also the biblical term for sex, is knowledge. Ba'adam yada et chava yishto, and Adam knew Chava, his wife. The idea that they had totally exposed themselves to each other, which is why ultimately this can only take place, and I'm answering my original question finally, in a committed relationship. Because it is unhealthy, it is truly unwise for anyone to expose themselves in any way to expose themselves too much to someone else. Who's going to do this? Who's going to reveal their most intimate secrets to someone who can disclose them to another person the next week? And that's why Judaism promotes marriage so much, because marriage is the best. It's not perfect, but it sets up the highest possible level of commitment, a safe zone, if you will, within which people can feel comfortable sharing and exposing themselves to the other person. So ultimately, we can be understood. And once you can be understood, you can be accepted, and we can deal with our existential loneliness that we're plagued with simply by virtue of being human. And as I said before, explains why the biblical term for sexual intimacy is knowledge. Adam yadat chava ishto. Adam knew his wife and she conceived. Sex is the ultimate way of knowing the other after one has fully exposed and revealed themselves within the safe environment we call marriage, where one feels comfortable revealing themselves. Because there's, now you'll say, well, Judaism does believe in divorce. The person could still leave. But I always say that if a person has to call a lawyer or a rabbi, and there's documents and all this red tape that you have to go through to create a relationship or dissolve one, you've got more commitment. And I've spoken to a lot of people who said, wait a minute, Rabbi, we are committed. We moved in with each other. We are committed. I said, somebody decides tomorrow they're not interested in staying in the relationship, what do they have to do to leave? Just walk out. If you want to be a mensch, sit down, have a conversation. I don't think this is working. I think we need to split up. And they leave. It needs to be more difficult. Why does it need to be more? Because a lot of people say, what do you need to get married, Bizman Hazeh? These days, people just move in. The marriage ceremony is just to make the grandparents feel nice. It's like an old-fashioned thing. Why? What does marriage actually add? And I'm very practical about it. What marriage adds is it sets up a level of commitment that makes it easier for people to really reveal who they truly are. And once we have that set up, we can feel more comfortable exposing ourselves. which is why in Judaism, classically, sexuality, touch, all of that is reserved for the marriage when there is that sense of full revelation. Otherwise, we're forced to hide our true selves from each other because we don't know if we can rely on this other person to stay the course. We don't know if we can rely on ourselves to stay the course. Now, here's the good news. The good news is that none of this has to be fully developed before we get married. Our contemporary society has somehow convinced us that we have to have whatever it is that marriage brings us in the relationship before the marriage actually starts. But that's what marriage is for itself. The years that we spend giving to each other to create that comfort zone, to really open and reveal ourselves, is precisely why we get married. It's not the criteria for marriage. What is the criteria then for marriage? Well, I mentioned three things before: shared values, physical attraction, and personality. Once you have those three things, Judaism really believes you move forward and you spend the rest of your life opening yourself up to the same person. When I was a kid, I never understood how two people could spend so much time with each other without killing each other. Like, what do you talk about? My wife and I just celebrated our 25th wedding anniversary a couple of weeks ago. And thank you. And it's like, I never understood before this happened, like, what do you, like, you have it? No, because you keep changing and your partner keeps changing and there's different aspects of you that are revealed in different experiences in life. And you have these shared experiences that reveal a different aspect of yourself. And by the way, we all change too. And that's what we're doing during the years of the marriage. I used to think that it's like, oh, everything is so great and exciting in the beginning. Got this marital bliss for the first year or two, and blah, blah, blah. And then little by little, it's just like a very slow death of the couple until they become so bored and ultimately disgusted with one. That's the way, you know, the old, by the way, if you put on, you know, listen to most, you know, stand-up comedians talk about marriage, that's the way marriage is discussed. Because there's a depth to the revelation, which takes a lifetime. Now, there's a little of a catch-22 because, you know, none of us is going to just like, you know, you seem pretty good, let's try it out. We're not going to do that. We need a little more. So we have to do a little opening up of ourselves. We have to do a little revealing, let the other person in a little, so you can hopefully like what you see a bit. And someone once said to me, Rabbi, if I'm not married, therefore I'm not in the safe zone. So by definition, I'm going to be reluctant to open up. But if I don't open up, then my ability to bond and connect with this other person is going to be limited. It's got this catch-22. So I always answer that in dating, we have to do a little opening up to get things moving, a little revealing of our inner selves, create that connection, feel some chemistry. But the ultimate revelation, the true exposure, which helps us feel understood and accepted, is really reserved for marriage, where we spend the rest of our lives looking and revealing even more. And that's my greatest advice, therefore, based on this sort of structure I set up with Adam 1 and Adam 2 from Rav Soloveitchik's work, is to try to find someone that you feel is beginning to understand you, okay, and that you have a desire to get to know better. That's so important. That curiosity is really where it's at. And assuming that this individual with whom you have shared values and there's some compatibility and physical attractiveness. And by the way, you're not going to get the 100% physical attraction. You're not going to get the 100% compatibility. You're not going to get the 100% shared value. There's always going to be a little of a compromise. But assuming you have those three things and a desire to know them and them you, then go out, buy a nice ring. This is primarily being said for the men listening here. Go out, buy a nice ring, and propose. Don't keep on feeling that you have to keep getting to know the other person so much more, to reveal more, to learn every single nuance about your partner. That's why we get married. We're just afraid because we don't want to make a mistake. And so many marriages, unfortunately, do end in divorce. and I'm sure many of us are the products of perhaps divorced parents, and we want to, you know, we want to get it right the first time, and we, you know, and we do all these things. And by the way, the whole moving in thing, I've heard so many times, like, I remember when I got engaged, so my wife, who doesn't come from an observant background, a religiously observant background, her friends took her out, and they were, like, really excited for her, and they were like, but you're going to move in for a couple of months together before you actually get married. I said, no, we don't really do that. She's like, well, how are you going to know? Like, what, whether he squeezes the toothpaste, he rolls the toothpaste, like, how are you going to know? Do you know that the rates of divorce are actually higher amongst couples that lived with each other before marriage? I'm not saying that was the cause, but the idea that I'm going to know every little thing about this person, and therefore I need to see the way they're here, the way they're over there. I'll tell you a story. My wife hates this story, but I think it's good for guys. It's good for everyone to hear. I think it's interesting. So one of my friends, older friend of mine, who was an amazing, amazing guy, was married by Rabbi Soloveitchik, meaning he was the officiating rabbi, this rabbi who wrote this book. And right before he was about to walk down the aisle, Rav Soloveitchik took him aside and looked at him and said, so, are you sure? Which is, by the way, a terrible thing to ask a groom before he's about to walk down the aisle. He freaked him out. Are you sure? Now, he didn't answer. He ended up becoming a psychiatrist, by the way, this guy. He's actually a very prominent psychiatrist. And he didn't know what to answer. So he didn't say anything. And Rav Soloveitchik said back to him, good, only a fool could be sure. There's no such thing as being sure. Now, sometimes, I haven't ever heard a guy say it, but I've heard some women say, oh yes, 100%. And maybe, I'm not trying to make fun. I do think women are more in touch with their emotions, and they might be better at being able to tell. But there's no certainty in life. And the idea that that we know, what we're trying to do is create something out of this. Whether the marriage is going to work or not is not simply based on whether I made the right decision at that moment when I propose. It's whether or not we do the right things for the next X amount of years together. It's whether we create that home with each other. And we've got the rest of our lives for that. And that's really, in my opinion, what makes marriage great, because if you keep on working on it, if a couple keeps on trying to get to know the other in their attempt to truly understand the other, then that deepens the bond and the true love develops. My mother of blessed memory always used to say this. She said, I loved your father before we met, but the love after marriage is not the same as love before marriage. It's not. It's like a big like before marriage. And love, does anybody know the Hebrew word actually for love? Such a beautiful, what's that? Ahava, which is rooted in the Hebrew term. Hey, vet. I told you, remember, I think I mentioned this, that every Hebrew word has a two or three letter root, a shoresh, which gives it away. Ahava is hav, which means to give. It's all about giving, doing for the other. They told the story of the great tzaddik of Yerushalayim, Rabbi Aryeh Levin, who goes with his wife to the doctor. She's complaining of severe pain in her leg. The doctor asks the rabbi, what's the matter? And he famously answers, he says, our leg hurts. And that's really love, when you feel a sense of oneness. And remember, Adam 1, they were one together. In Adam 2, he was alone. And what does it say in chapter 2, Adam 2? That at some point, Al ken yazov ish et imo ve'et aviv, at some point a man will leave his mother and his father, v'davak v'ishto, and he will cleave unto his wife, v'hayu lebasar echad, and they will become one flesh. That is the goal. It's our leg. They literally become one. One last point, and I'll finish with this. And that is an amazing song by an amazing band. All You Need Is Love, by the Beatles. And it's a little deceiving. And I wouldn't suggest that this is really a Torah concept. Because as far as Judaism is concerned, love cannot conquer all. love can't substitute for other important values in relationships. And that's why a lot of couples do part, even though they love each other. Because there has to be other things there. Having another person who understands us can help big time. But the only being that truly knows us even better, as I mentioned before, than our spouses, is God, our creator. And that's why Soloveitchik says that Adam and Eve together formed what he calls a faith community. They connect with each other, but their bond also allows them to connect with something beyond themselves. And by the way, I've said this to so many couples, that the most important thing for a couple to do is not simply have a date night so they can focus on themselves and look after themselves and be a good listener. And all those things are great and they're all true. But just as important is that they do things for other people. They connect themselves with something beyond themselves, because love is not the answer to everything in Judaism. Love's a major important emotion to cultivate in Torah, but it's not the end all and be all. All you need is love, great song, great band, but Torah would not necessarily acknowledge that we need something else beyond ourselves. And that's why I love telling couples, you know, what's your project as a couple? What are you going to do for someone else? You're inviting people to your home. Maybe you're fixing up singles. Maybe you're, I don't know, whatever the cause is. Now, I think every human being, whether you're married or single, should be involved in a cause. And if you can come on Sunday and give us some of your blood or whatever it is that you want to do to help other people, all the studies show that's what makes us fulfilled. Is not filling up our own pockets, but emptying them a little and sharing it with others. And when you get married, it doubles. It doubles because the couple now has the ability to do things as a couple for others. And who's the paradigm for this, by the way? Which couple is the paradigm in the Torah for this? It's in this parsha, Avram and Sarah. Okay, they had this incredible relationship, but the relationship, I think, was incredible, not only because they did for others, but also because they weren't simply focused on each other. Husbands and wives need to be partners in a mission which is greater than themselves. And the rabbis teach that the Hebrew word for a man, anybody? Ish. And the Hebrew word for a woman, Isha, differ by only two letters, the Yud and the He, which spell God's name, which teaches that if God is in the relationship, something beyond you, something above you, if they're living for something beyond themselves, then a man and a woman be great, harmony. But if God is not present in the relationship, if there's no Yud and there's no He, God's name, you take it out, what is the man and woman's name spell now? Aish, fire, which explains how the most potentially explosive, like disastrous and explosive relationships are also husbands and wives. Right, the two people who can love each other the most and, God forbid, kill each other the most are husbands and wives. Right, and because when there's a focus on something higher, the couple comes together to achieve something greater, then the relationship can be the most beautiful thing in the world. And so when we date, I'm going to stop talking. If you have any questions or comments, when we date, we should really be asking ourselves, is this someone with whom I can build a home? I wouldn't ask your date that on like the first date, you know, it's a little too pressuring. But is this someone I can work with to raise a great family, with whom I can have children, through whom I can transmit the values that I hold dear so I can leave this world a better place than I found it? And that's why when we always encourage people who are Jewish to date Jewish people or dating others on a similar Jewish path, it's not just so that sociologically, yeah, it increases the likelihood the relationship will work out. If people are very, very different, practically it's true. It makes it harder to make it work. But the idea is deeper, is to accomplish not just for ourselves, but to build our people and to build the world. And by doing this as a unit. Anyway, those are my thoughts and my blessing. I'll just leave everyone with a bracha because this area is fraught with complications and challenges, as I'm sure we could all agree, is that you find that special someone who understands you and with whom you can do great things for other people. It's a really good question to ask ourselves next time you're out, because automatically we just like, can this person do this for me? Can this person do that? They'll be good for this, but not good. And I'm not saying we shouldn't do any of that. Got the list. Just trim the list a little. But another question is, Do I want to get to know this person better? Does this person want to get to me know better? Want to get to know me better? The idea of being understood. And number two, is this someone I want to partner with to do great things for someone else? Not me, and not even her or him, but for people we don't even know. That to me is a recipe for success, for a successful relationship. And by the way, I don't have the time, but if you go through all of the relationships, not just Abraham and Sarah, but Rebecca and Isaac and Rachel and Leah, which was a whole complicated sister situation with Jacob, they all have this as a common denominator. They were all focused on something greater than themselves. Now, the book of Genesis, Sefer Bereishit, that we're reading in these parsha now definitely speaks about their individual personal relationships and the problems and issues that they had having children and getting upset about that and trying to fix the problem and all their issue, personal issues that came up. But you see that they're all trying to build the Jewish people. And that focus on something beyond, I just think that's so helpful for the internal personal relationship. Okay, I'm just babbling at this point. Any questions or comments, please? Because I really try to not talk too long. If anyone has any questions or comments, please.
What was the Yud-Hey part that you were making?
So it says Ish and Isha. Oh, Ish is the Hebrew word for man. Isha is a woman. And the Yud and the Hey is what's separating. So when that's in it, they're good. When it's out, it turns into Ish, which means fire. That's like a little, it's a famous rabbinic teaching. Yeah. Thank you, Chase. Thanks for not letting me hang.
How does that connect to Abraham, Avram and Sarai? Because they were known as Avram and Sarai and still as the loyal Hashem followers. In the beginning, yes, there was the name change, but it almost seems like the before part should have been a non-devotion to Hashem at that point.
The reason for the name changes are very different. Nothing really to do with this conversation.
Okay.
Avram's name was changed from Avram to Avraham. I always make the joke, Abram to Abraham. They gave him the ham. Well, anybody know why Avram's name was changed? What's that?
Five for Moses?
Right. So the Torah actually says it explicitly. That v'loy kareshim cha Avram ela Avraham, because ki av hamon goyim nesaticha, because you are now going to be the av, the father of the goyim of all the nations, have I made you. And the Talmud interprets that, saying that before, when his name was just Avram, he was av la Aram Naharayim, he was the father of where he came from, a place called Aram Naharayim, ancient Mesopotamia. It was a more of a local. And now he's supposed to be Av L'chol Olam, which really denotes that Judaism is supposed to be more of a universal kind of faith. And it's not really only for Jews, per se. That Avraham's task was to promote ethical monotheism, not just to one particular people, but literally to the entire world. It's nothing to do with relationships, really. That's all. And Sarai got her Yud in there for other reasons, too. Nothing to do with what we're discussing. I'm sure there's some interpretation, though, that could connect it back to the Yud and the... Yeah.
Hey, it wasn't a bad thought.
Right, he got the Hay and she got the Yud. You could do the same thing. Good point. I'm just trying to follow the text. The text says, Ki av hamon goyim, because of the multitude of the nations, you know? But anything else, just, I don't know. Please. Whoa. So Danielle's asking about the verse I just quoted, that a person is supposed to leave his mother and his father and cling to their, a man cling to his wife. So there is nothing in there. The implication is that the parents aren't going to make that process difficult, because the parents have to let go. The parents have to somehow allow the child to detach. And this is a big issue that comes up often that does keep some people from... You know, it takes two to tango. It's not always entirely the parents' fault. Sometimes it is, where the parents just don't want to let go. And it's very, very hard for a child to see themselves independent of the parents. And if you can't see yourself as independent, it's very hard to latch on to something or someone else, because you still got that connection. Now, that connection is always still there. We're supposed to continue to respect our parents until 120. The mitzvah of kibud av va'em, of honoring our parents, you know, doesn't stop after we grow up. So it's, you know, there's no direct verse in the text in the Bible that says, let go, mommy and daddy, let them move on. Stop holding on, stop babying your child. But the implication is, you know, I'll give you the other example. It says in the Torah, honor your mother and your father. Rav Hirsch, great German Jewish philosopher, said that parents have to make sure not to make it too difficult for kids to honor their parents. Now, it doesn't say that anywhere in the Torah, but the implication is if you want your kids to be able to fulfill this mitzvah, don't make it impossible for them. And the implication, I think, with that verse also, if you want your kids to be able to attach themselves to their soulmates, then the parents need to let go at some point. And it's not a natural thing. It doesn't happen naturally. It's something that needs to be worked on. I have older kids, not so simple. You become very, very attached to your kids. And you want them to be happy. So hopefully your desire for your children's happiness will overcome whatever other emotional attachments you may have to them. And if you recognize that this is, you know, that's ultimately what enables them to be happy, is to detach so they can attach to someone else, then you're going to do it. But there's no like biblical command or anything like that. Like, thou shalt leave them alone. That's what you're looking for. It's good. It's an interesting question. Any other comments, questions, relationships? It's so simple now, right? No problem. We're on the topic. Feel free to ask. I guarantee you someone else is thinking about it right now. You don't have to. I won't put you on the spot.
I have a question.
Yeah, Juliet. Yeah, please. So
what would the... what would the Jewish perspective be for those who maybe have been at this for a while and having a hard time? Maybe it's taken them longer than they thought it would.
Yeah.
Like, what is the lesson here? They're not doing enough opening up. They're not.
Well, I can't tell you. Everybody is different. It may be that you are opening up properly. It could very well be that you're not. It could very well be that you are. The one lesson I would give is what I just read. Jay Brody, who got engaged just like 2 weeks ago, I said he wanted to sponsor Kiddush at the MG Minyan. Oh, it was like a month ago. So I said, what do you want to say on the bulletin, the Shabbat bulletin? You know, Mazel Tov. He said, just write the words, don't give up. I was at it for a really long time. And I found somebody, don't give up. Please tell that to everyone. He wants everyone to hear that. So that's number one. Oh, he also said, keep coming back to MG, because he met his wife here. 368, not that we're counting. 22 years, 368 couples, not bad. It could very well be that we are very guarded and we're not sufficiently opening ourselves up to someone else. There's a million and one possibilities as to why we haven't been able to either find, or perhaps we did find, but for whatever reason, we weren't able to make, you know, a lasting, a committed relationship out of. You know, it depends. I'm a big believer in therapy. I do, because I don't think I can give a one answer fits all to this question. It's an excellent question. The only thing and therefore I would really recommend that you have a coach. I think relationship building today has become extraordinarily complicated, and therefore everyone needs a mentor or coach. Doesn't have to be a paid therapist necessarily, although it could be, but it has to be someone who can be objective and who cares about you and understands you a little and can help discuss with you when you're dating someone, so that, and it's always helpful to have that person to talk to while you're dating. So it's not in a vacuum. You're not just talking about you in vague generalities, but it's actually speaking about your feelings, your emotions vis-a-vis this other person. I think everyone needs a coach. I don't think we can go at this alone. Could be your parents, it could be a parent, it could be a cousin, it could be, but it should be someone, in my opinion, who's married, who has a maybe a little more realistic understanding of marriage, I think that's really important. And by the way, I don't subscribe to the idea just because someone's married, they know everything about relationships now. There are plenty of messed up marriages, as we all know. But someone who has a sense of what it takes to create and to sustain a committed relationship is much better to talk to than someone who doesn't really, you know, who's struggling themselves with doing just that. So I think a coach is really, really important. I also think what I said before, just harping back what I said before, trying to trim the list. That doesn't mean you're settling. It means you are being real. Because there doesn't exist that perfect individual. And when people feel that perhaps they found that perfect, that's great. That's so wonderful that an individual has found it. But there are, of course, real issues that every relationship has. So just know, it's just a question, what are your issues going to be? There's no such thing as not. But I wouldn't compromise on the shared values, on the physical attraction, and on the personality within reason on all those three things. So,
thank you.
I hope that helps. I hope that helps. Yes.
I have a lot of conversations with friends and even in my own relationship in life about like the idea of being ready. So it's less like a fear of commitment. You know, everyone is like, yeah, I know that I want to marry my boyfriend one day, or even like not even one day so far off. Like, yeah, I just need like another 6 months, or I just need another like year before I get engaged. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on like how, like, do you know if you're ready? Do you think there are certain markers that like are worth asking yourself? And is it ever worth it to, I mean, I'm sure it is worth it, but like, when is it worth it to really give yourself that time?
Okay, so Hannah's asking an excellent question. You know, when is it worth it to stay with someone that you're already in a relationship with for a longer period of time? Are you also asking like how long, you know?
I mean, I don't think there's an answer to how long, right? But I do think like it's very easy to just continually tell yourself like, you know, I don't feel like I'm ready to get engaged right now.
Right.
I love my significant other and want to marry now.
But, right.
Like, maybe I'll be ready in 6 months.
So you have to ask yourself, you have to really drill down, what is it that you don't feel you're ready for? Is it because you're not sure about this other person? Or is it you're really not sure about whether or not you're ready to make, to be married? Now, part of me is like, well, if you're not really ready to be married, then, you know, why are you in this relationship to begin? You know, well, I don't know, maybe it just happened, you met, who knows? I do think people stay with each other sometimes way too long and often blow the relationship because they keep thinking they're going to find something else. And again, I'm generalizing here, but after a certain amount of time with someone, I think you know enough to make that commitment. It's just that we're afraid. And we keep therefore thinking, if I have a little more, if I see them in this scenario, see them in that scenario, at some point after a few months, when you're a mature individual already, I'm not talking about someone who's very, very young, but someone who is, I don't know, at a certain age already where they understand themselves pretty well and they have a good assessment of this other person to say, well, I want to see them how they do this. I want to go through all the four seasons with them. I need to see how they act at the Seder table with the parents. So I got to wait till Pesach. Now I need to see how they like eating dairy on Shavuos, and let's wait till Shavuos. You know, on some level, I don't really think it adds anything. I think it actually creates more stress often. However, if you yourself don't feel you're ready to be married, then that's a problem. I think that's an issue. And I think you might want to hold off. You know, you have another person now. So you have to really be honest with the other person and say, listen, I'm really feeling great about us, but I just don't know if I'm personally ready. But I'm a big believer, as I said, in therapy and trying to schmooze those issues out. But I'll tell you, like, there's such a gap between, let's say, in the very, very orthodox circles where people get married very quickly because they're not looking for that compatibility as much because they believe so much in, and I'm not saying I did this either. I don't live in that world either. My wife and I dated probably 7 or 8 months and then we were engaged for a few more months. I couldn't just... But at some point, you know that like you've got enough to go on here. You're just either stalling because you're afraid or there's some other issue that you really need to resolve, you know. But I'll tell you a funny story to show you the gap with the way, like, we're dating in our secular world and the way dating happens in the very Orthodox world. So we went and on our Israel trip, we went to this big, big rabbi, Rav Nevensol. I used to go every summer with our group to hear him. And inevitably, and we do an Ask the Rabbi, he's very wise, brilliant, brilliant rabbinic figure. He's a chief rabbi of the old city, Jerusalem. And there's always someone that asks, how long do you know? So how many times, you know, how long should you stay with us? This one woman asked the question, you know, if you bid with somebody, you know, how many more times, you know, how much longer should you stay with them? Like one or two more? And she was very vague when she said one or two. So I translated if the rabbi only spoke Hebrew. And so the rabbi said, you know, yeah, one or two, that should be enough. So I said back to the woman, one or two. And she's like, one or two what, dates or years? So I turned back to the rabbi and I said to him, like, you know, shanim o pigishot, you know, years or you know, he's like, pigishot, you know, like dates. Go out a few dates and then you'll know. And I said to the woman, she's thinking in years, he's thinking in dates, you know? And that's like the gap. Now, the reason being is because if you are committed to getting married and you believe so much in the institution of marriage, then you just want to find someone with a similar enough background, similar enough goals that you have, and that you have a basic level of physical attraction. You're good to go. It's not such a crazy thing. Now, I'm not saying I can do that. I didn't grow up in that culture, and I don't think I personally could make that kind of leap after just a few dates. I'd have to feel in a relationship already. But they don't feel the need to be in a real relationship like that necessarily, because they believe so much in the institution of marriage, they're going to make it work as long as we have the shared values. Physically, we can be happy to be with each other, and then we're going to make everything else work. Now, I'm not suggesting anyone goes to that extreme. I'm sharing it because I think it puts a little thing in the back of our mind that maybe we're overcomplicating things a little, because it's really about finding someone that we can be on the same page enough to build something together. The question of, is he going to make me happy? Is she going to make me happy? I just think is so overrated. Happiness in life, and this was last week's class. What did we say last week about happiness? What does it come from? It comes from purpose and meaning. There's no such thing as running after happiness per se. There's such a thing as running after a life of meaning and purpose. Torah, mitzvot, like a guide through a spiritual path to accomplish certain things. That's what brings joy. That's what brings happiness. So if you're looking for someone to do that stuff with, and it takes a little of the pressure off a little of having this perfect relationship where you're each other's yin and yang. And it's like, we expect a little too much out of love. There was this great scene in, movie about, it was one of my wife made me watch it, but it was like definitely like a chick flick that she forced me to watch it. I absolutely love though. No, it's close to that. It's close to that. But what's that? No. She's a singer. She's this great singer. She was on in the Super Bowl. She sang for the Super Bowl last year. Help me. Not Lady Gaga. Jennifer Lopez.
It's the Wedding Planner.
The Wedding Planner. Thank you. There's a scene. I'm like, what was that? The Wedding Planner was this one scene. Do you remember the Italian guy? What was his name? Did anyone see the movie? Such a sweet movie. Massimo. Remember the Italian guy? What was his name? Massimo. Remember Massimo? And he has this one line, and they came from the same background, and he had this cute little, and he wanted to marry her. And he's like, you know, you're making such a big deal about love. Love can't handle that. It's too much for love. Like, he just was trying to keep it simple. We're attracted to each other and we want to build the same thing. Come on. You know, whatever. It sort of captured this a little. You'll see the movie again. It's a good date movie to see. All right. Any other questions or comments? Thank you all for participating. This was great. What's our topic next week? What are we doing? Do we know? Or we'll get it to you. Oh, it's so sad. But we're going to continue.
I forgot off the top of my head, but I do have information about a...
Oh, the relationship thing.
Relationship.
All right, I'm going to hand it back to Maya for the relationship thing. And thanks for participating, everyone, guys. Really a pleasure.
Hi, everybody. Hi, everybody in person. I wanted to tell you about the Kesha Relationship Seminar called Fall in Love. It's a virtual event. We are partnering with a synagogue in California. Yeah, we've partnered with him in the past. And so basically, I will send you the link. We get a special, MJers get a special 40% off. It is on November 15th from 1 p.m. to 7 p.m. So you can come in, donate blood, and then join the online virtual event. It's 6 hours of content, special guest speakers like Dr. Chapman and Rabbi Shmuley Boteach, who has also spoken with MJE. The content is also available for replay. So if, you know, your blood donation appointment runs into the speaker you want to see, you can always rewatch it. And I will send you guys the link. And it's basically a way for you to connect with Jewish singles, hear from experts, talk about the five love languages, kosher sex, and create and achieve relationship goals. So if you engage with this class and this is a topic that you want to learn more about, this is a really great resource and I can send everyone the link to that. And also we will be having a Friday night dinner this Friday at New Amsterdam Burger. A few of you who are here in person were there last month and it was really great. And so we're going to be doing that again. It is Thanksgiving theme. So we have some really yummy Thanksgiving food lined up. There's going to be some yummy soup and pie and really just sort of spend some time with our MJA community in person, celebrating Shabbat together. There is a discount for those in fellowship and it's cohort. Outside. Yeah. Oh, it's outdoors. The weather is looking really nice for this weekend. So we really hope you can join us. Please feel free to email me if you have any questions. And thank you so much, everyone, for joining. Rabbi Wilds, do you have anything else to say? Thank you, everybody. Thank you, everyone online. Thank you, everyone on Facebook.